From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Welcome to New Year's weekend and the concluding segment of our special two-part 2020 in review installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap that we kicked off here last weekend. This has been an extraordinary year. Non-stop news, seemingly insurmountable challenges, accomplishments, tragedies, and a real test of the human spirit and ingenuity. We've dealt with a biological assault on our health, polarization in our politics, stress in our economy, a reckoning between our races, and an erosion of our trust. But when all is said and done, we shall prevail. We put together an outstanding lineup of guests with keen insights into the stuff of our extraordinary times. Stand by, as we're about to be joined by people with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation, all part of the increasingly noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to part two of our special year-end installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of 2020's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, let's rock. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, Executive Editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America during the astonishingly historic year of 2020.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10, climate change, severe weather, numerous hurricanes, and wildfires. We saw a record number of hurricanes and other categories of so-called named storms in 2020, which, in addition to the outbreak of historically horrendous wildfires that took lives and properties, prompted a tremendous amount of talk media discussion about the still politically controversial topic of climate change.
But climate change was not the only notable aspect of the conversation expressed on News Talk Radio that was generated by natural disasters. News Talk Radio is a media first responder that serves the public well-being during these kinds of emergencies, providing vital information, relief, and encouragement when the lights go out, the water rises, the earth trembles, and the flames invade residential areas.
At number 9, U.S.-China relations. 2020 was the year that the American public gained heightened awareness to the point of revelation that China has been mounting a 21st century style multi-front offensive against American interests in business, trade, cyber surveillance, and military strategy following its admittance into the World Trade Organization in 2001. The straw that broke the camel's back, however, was the communist nation's murky and extremely suspicious role in the origins and spread of misinformation pertaining to COVID-19.
If there's any one thing both the supporters and foes of President Trump have in common, it's general agreement that he was on the right track in his calling attention to America's China problem. And if President-elect Biden is smart, regardless of his past political history on the issue and the current investigation of his son's alleged connections to Beijing, he'll continue during his forthcoming presidency to follow the hardline course set by Trump.
At number 8, the Michael Flynn and Roger Stone cases. Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's early national security advisor, and Roger Stone, one of his longtime political advisors and strategists, were both convicted and sentenced to prison for crimes committed on behalf of the administration, only to be recently pardoned by the president amidst a lot of controversy.
In many ways, they became the poster children for Trump detractors to focus on the nonstop media and political campaign to paint the president and his inner circle as being shady and unlawful. Whether or not there's truth to that depiction, we leave it up to you.
At number 7, the impeachment of Donald Trump. By the time the Trump impeachment trial hit the Senate during the first month of 2020, it was a foregone conclusion that it would have no chance of reaching a guilty verdict in the Republican-controlled senior chamber. And of course, as we all know, it didn't.
As we present this year in review, it's hard to believe how much news has broken and how much our world has changed since January of 2020. The impeachment seems like an eternity ago.
At number 6, Supreme Court changes and appointments. The passing of iconic liberal Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the age of 87 in September led to President Donald Trump having the opportunity to appoint three new Supreme Court justices during his four-year term, a legacy moving the court to a conservative majority that could last for decades.
It also sparked a major debate about the ethics of whether to make such appointments before or after a presidential election and the possibility of the Democrats packing the court in the event of a Biden victory.
At number five, social media censorship. The awesome power and influence of social and digital media venues such as Facebook, Twitter, and Google prompted a massive amount of controversy in 2020 about the legal status of such entities as either platforms or publishers, shining the spotlight on exactly what constitutes their liabilities and responsibilities, both ethically and under the law, in terms of the accuracy of their content.
This discussion has tapped into the very heart and soul of exactly what the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States means in the wild frontier of the rapidly accelerating digital era.
At number four, the economy and unemployment. 2020 has been a devastating year for the economy, with COVID-19 putting severe restraints on businesses and entities based on human beings gathering in crowded situations such as restaurants, theaters, sporting events, public transportation, schools, and conventions. These lives versus livelihood issues sparked a nonstop debate over government's lawful and ethical role in dictating closures and restrictions on this aspect of day-to-day life. The very definition of the term normal has become an extremely subjective concept.
COVID-19 has instigated massive first-time unemployment claims, and as the year draws to a close, Congress has finally agreed upon the second of two stimulus packages that, although helpful, have proven to be a weak remedy for a problem that will certainly bedevil us going deep into 2021 and possibly well beyond. A subset of the business and economic turmoil we're experiencing has been the accompanying crisis in education caused by widespread school closings and disruption.
At number three, the Black Lives Matter movement, race relations, and police reform. In the midst of a health and economic crisis, a series of incidents involving excessive police violence and brutality against black citizens, highlighted by the unnecessary killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, triggered a wave of summertime street protests, some peaceful, some violent, in urban centers across America, and the escalation of the Black Lives Matter movement to the center stage of the national conversation. It has been described as a great racial reckoning in America.
This led to a strong national movement, at first to actually defund the police, and eventually to simply reform police policies, procedures, and attitudes in carrying out their relationship with the community, regardless of color, ethnicity, or economic status.
At number two, the 2020 presidential election. It generated the most massive turnout in modern electoral history under complex pandemic conditions that included the extensive use of mail-in ballots, triggering allegations of voter fraud, and President Trump's refusal to recognize the legitimacy of Joe Biden's victory.
As we come to the end of 2020, the country is extremely politically polarized. One side believes that President Trump's refusal to recognize the election presents the gravest threat ever posed to American democracy. The other side believes the exact opposite, that it's the only thing that can save American democracy.
And at number one, the COVID-19 pandemic. The coronavirus was not only the biggest story of the year, it certainly must be considered one of the most consequential of the past 100 years. Its impact on both physical and mental health, politics, the economy, education, social norms, technology, sports, and personal relationships is incalculable.
Fortunately, as we produce this year in review during the holiday season of 2020, multiple vaccines have been approved and the distribution and inoculations have begun. There is indeed light at the end of the tunnel and a spark of hope that will begin working our way out of this deep, dark, tragic mess in what will hopefully be a turnaround year. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Rap. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Rap. Let's begin the second half of our two-part year in review by heading over to America's Playground and a visit with a local Atlantic City, New Jersey radio morning talk show legend who served as vice president of one of Donald Trump's hotels for several years before beginning his remarkable 29-year career on WPG, Harry Hurley.
Harry, in last week's part one of our two-part year in review story, we talked about the economy and how there are new methods out there of keeping things sterile and clean. Do you think that the pandemic will have pushed us forward, as some people are observing, in terms of the technology and the social norms of just having a higher consciousness of public health?
Without a doubt, Michael, unbelievable point, a perfect question. We looked, just look at it this way, 10 months ago, we would look at other countries around the world when they were wearing face masks and almost think, if we wouldn't dare say it out loud, but we would think, what's wrong with them? What are they wearing masks for? What's
That's
that
true.
About?
That's true.
Is it the pollution? Is it something else? I mean, what do they have going on? We wouldn't even imagine wearing face masks and things like that. Here's what I think. The pandemic will end. We will go back to recreating. We will fill stadiums. We will fill concert halls. And we will go back to normal. Not a new normal. We will go back to normal. However, there'll be lasting effects. I think people are going to be more conscious about their washing hands, using hand sanitizer, picking and choosing where they think that hotels, restaurants, stores that are clean and obviously clean, that you see that they bioblast and that they do important things in terms of inspiring confidence. So even when it's over, once bitten, twice shy, I think people will be still very careful about where they go and make decisions where they won't go. And then that will be the free market will decide, and the strongest will survive. I think half the restaurants could be gone in America before this is over.
Harry, you worked with President Trump. As a matter of fact, you were his vice president, but not of the United States. You were vice president and in charge of one of his hotels for several years prior to your fabulous 29-year career as the morning mayor of Atlantic City. And you have some insights into his personality. And again, after all these decades, you are his friend and you have been his supporter, but without criticism here and there of a policy or two. What would you say to President Trump if he said, Harry, did I do anything wrong? What? Where did I blow this? How did I lose this election, aside from the claims of fraud?
Well, it's all COVID-19. Without the pandemic, President Trump would have earned a resounding second term. So it's all COVID-19. Where I think they lost it, I don't think necessarily the president lost it, because you have to take the whole person. He is who he is. He's not warm and fuzzy, but he is a tremendous executive. He's tremendous at accomplishing things. And when you look at the economy, record market highs, when you look at employment across the board, this is why it was no accident that he received the highest minority vote. Think about that. In a losing effort, it's really extraordinary, than any president since Richard Nixon in 1960. Extraordinary what he did. Where he lost it, I think he lost it in public relations. It's a shame, and I love the people that he has around him, but he had the media going against him for the most part, and they were never going to make anything look good. When he said, we're going to have a vaccine before the end of the year, they called him basically one flew over the cuckoo's nest, and it would be a miracle to have a vaccine by the end of the year, and of course we do. And we'll have 100 million people vaccinated within days after into the new year. Where I think he lost it was that he doesn't have the warm and fuzzy personality, and you can't fake sincerity. He was perfect before a pandemic. The pandemic goes to the guy that people think has more empathy. The president is more empathetic than he gets credit for, but perception, unchallenged or not successfully challenged, is reality. That's where I think he lost it, because his effort, the USS Comfort, the other battleship-turned-hospital in California, the PPE, the ventilators, the call to arms, the effort was unprecedented in world history. Operation Warp Speed, he got credit for nothing. And when he told the truth, the media said he lied, and then he wasn't warm and fuzzy, and he wouldn't wear a mask. So all these things pile up, and the perception becomes the reality. All the good is forgotten. This entire election, much like 1876, the entire election was focused on one thing, and on only that one thing. If you say economy, Trump wins over Biden. If you say any number of things, employment, all these different things, Trump wins over Biden. The only thing he didn't win over Biden was empathy for handling the pandemic. And that was the determinative factor.
That's the honorary morning mayor of Atlantic City, New Jersey, Harry Hurley of WPG Radio, as we continue with the second half of our special two-part 2020 in review. Coming up next, part two of our visit with talk show host Mandy Connell of KOA in Denver. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career: Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics. Also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with part two of our special edition of the Michael Harrison Wrap for New Year's weekend, as we look back at the most talked about stories and issues of 2020. We're joined now for the second week in a row by radio talk show host Mandy Connell of KOA in Denver. Mandy, in last week's program, we covered a lot about the economy, and we certainly got into the election and the politics and the personality and policies of Donald Trump. What's your view of the education crisis that we've had in America in 2020?
I have been a huge proponent of school choice for this very reason. I've been very disappointed with some of the changes that have occurred over the last 20 years, especially when it comes to the teaching of history, the teaching of the Constitution. I read a profoundly disturbing survey years ago that said two-thirds of college students could only tell you that the Founding Fathers owned slaves. That was the only thing they knew about the Founding Fathers. And though I think we need to do a better job at including all of the aspects of our history, good, bad, and indifferent, we have to get back to teaching some semblance of how the country was founded. And for me, you know, I'm a big fan of telling students that they can achieve and raising the bar and then encouraging them to reach that bar. And what frustrates me about our current state of education is that it feels like whenever one group of students can't succeed, instead of focusing like a laser on helping those students achieve, we then dumb down the rest of the school. And that's been very frustrating to me. So I'm hoping that parents who have now spent a year teaching their kids at home are becoming more aware of what's in the curriculums and what's not, and they will become more involved. Now, is that going to happen? I don't know. But currently, right now, in most places in the United States, the teachers' unions are writing the curriculums, they're setting the tone, and they're introducing things in school like Black liberation theory that I think are absolutely harmful, not just for white kids, but for Black kids as well. And something's got to give. I have my kid in a charter school. I'm very active in her charter school. And that's the choice I've made as a parent. And I just hope that other parents will sort of wake up and say, this isn't good enough. But I'm not confident that's going to happen, because they too went to not so great schools. So I don't have an answer for that one.
What about claims of bias on the college and university level, that it's predominantly liberal and that students are indoctrinated and that conservative students are facing a very difficult time, you know, whether there's the COVID or not? This has been an issue that's been going on for a long time. What do you think?
Michael, I get emails from people on a semi-regular basis. These are college students who will write me with some ridiculous statement or you know, lecture that they've had to consume from one of their professors. And they want to know how they can push back, but not too hard, because if they push back too hard, then that's going to end up with them getting a bad grade in the classroom. There has to be more effort by universities to increase diversity of political thought in their teaching and in their teaching assistants. The problem is that why in the world would a staunch conservative want to go work in a place where he or she was going to be ostracized by his or her peers? The problem is, how do you get those people in the schools when we've seen over and over and over again that if you don't toe the line, you can lose your job, you can be fired, you can be removed from positions? And that's happened from Ivy League down to Evergreen College in Washington. So I will tell you, I have a college fund for my daughter who's 11, but if she comes to me at the age of 19 and says, "Mom, I don't want to go to college. I have a business plan. I want to do this instead," I would probably be inclined to say, "Go ahead, make it happen." Hmm. We'll have to see in 7 years how that goes. Check that then.
Well, it's hard to predict what anything's going to be like in 7 years, but I suspect that there is a changing of consciousness about the role of higher education and colleges and universities in terms of just their very structure. You know, is it healthy to send young people off for 4 years to what some people consider to be summer camp? I mean,
yeah, I agree. I mean, I love the concept of college, but we have kids coming out of school right now with $60,000 in debt and a degree in gender studies that is going to get them a job at a coffee shop. That to me is criminal. You know, that to what's happening to students with student debt, that they're being sold by higher education with really no way to pay it back with the degrees that they're attaining. That to me is a big, big, big problem that universities need to address at their own peril. You know, I mean, how many times do you have to say, you're going to get out of college with a degree that's not going to get you a job that pays anything? And oh, by the way, here's your $70,000 in debt. That's crazy, and young kids are too stupid to realize the repercussions. You know, when you're 18 or 19, you have no idea. You're listening to people who are experts, and you're trying to make good decisions, and then when you're 30, you can't buy a house because your student loan debt is insane. That is, any other industry would have been shut down by now, you know, but in higher ed, it's applauded as diversity.
In conclusion, this has also been a year in which the word suicide has popped up more often than it has in past years. There is a case to be made, and it's borne by research. You read it in the psychology magazines and journals, that there's a terrible level of despair, depression, aggravation, worry, and even thoughts of suicide in our nation. What are your thoughts about that?
I actually lost a very dear friend to suicide earlier this year, and the mental health crisis, and I'm going to call it a crisis, even though I hate that we make everything a crisis in this country, is significant. And I think that the reasons are vast and many, but the most disturbing suicide statistic that I'm hearing now is that teen suicide is off the charts. We have a very rural portion of Colorado in the Northeast. I mean, really rural, you know, like not very many people. They've had 7 high school students kill themselves this year since March. Prior to that, in the 15 years prior to that, they had had 4 suicides, Michael. This is a tragedy, because suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary situation. And we're doing a lousy job letting kids know that, as horrible as this is, it's going to pass. As horrible as whatever's happening in your life, it's going to pass. And if you're having any kind of suicide ideation or just depression, please, for the love of God, reach out and get help. Because as a person who I consider myself a survivor, because I will tell you, losing a friend to suicide is devastating. And the amount of guilt that I feel still to this day, even though it wasn't my fault, I know all of that, is tremendous. And if you want to burden your friends and family with that, the better way is to get some help, live through this moment in time, and come out on the other side stronger and better for it. So, yeah, I think it's an absolute nightmare what's happening right now, especially for kids.
That's talk show host Mandy Connell of radio station KOA in Denver. You're plugged into part two of our special year-in-review edition of the Michael Harrison Wrap. Heading back to the East Coast now, and our go-to guy for all things having to do with cybersecurity, digital media, and the law. Part two of our conversation kicked off last week with professor of law at Bentley University in Boston and the founder of Scamicide.com, Steve Weisman. In last week's program, we talked about the power of Facebook, the power of Google. We talked about the difference between platforms and publishing. Subsequently, as we came to the end of the year, there's this massive lawsuit being for antitrust activity that's being that Facebook is being hit with, and you and I have discussed that on this program over the years. Let's switch gears now to a related area that is within your wheelhouse, and there's another term that is overused, but in this case, it is your wheelhouse, and that is the whole issue of cybersecurity and hacking. You and I talked in the past couple of weeks about just how severe this Russian hacking of federal agencies has been. Where do you see that as of now, and where are we heading into 2021 in dealing with cyber warfare?
Yeah, cyber warfare is huge, and the incursion into American society by the recent Russian hacking, we're just finding out the extent. It was not just into the federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, including the Department of Defense, but a lot of major companies as well. Way back when, then FBI Director James Comey once said, there are two kinds of companies in America. There are the companies that have been hacked by the Chinese, and there are the companies that don't know they've been hacked by the Chinese. And he was talking about particularly theft of intellectual property by China. This has become an incredibly large threat. Now, granted, the sophistication that it took for the recent Russian hacking is not something that terrorist groups or criminal groups will have. But with the start of artificial intelligence growing so much, this is a real existential threat to societies around the world. I mean, it allows rogue states such as North Korea. North Korea, it's the biggest place it makes money. It doesn't have much in the way of industry. It does international cyber bank robberies. So if there is any hope, what I see is this most recent Russian action may be the clarion call that gets not just the United States government, but worldwide governments to start cooperating when it comes to cybersecurity and rules for warfare, just like we have rules for warfare outside of the cyber realm. I think we're going to actually start to see a movement toward that coming up in the next year.
Back in the Cold War, we had this term MAD, mutually assured destruction, and that's what kept rational countries, I guess, and I put that in quotes, such as the Soviet Union and the United States and Red China, from blowing each other off the face of the earth. You know, mutually assured destruction was actually a protection. Is it possible that we'll have some type of mutually assured destruction barrier to cyber warfare as part of that cooperation that you mentioned? And how is the U.S. in terms of its arsenal in this cyber war to be able to keep the others at bay?
It's interesting that you put it that way, because I don't think most people are aware, but yes, we do have that. And that was the risk that Russia took recently in this most recent incursion. Now, here's the thing. If Russia has gone into China and Iran into some of our infrastructure and things that are really important, like power plants and water. This is something that we have already done there, too. So we're already practicing that defense of mutually assured destruction. It's one of the more interesting aspects of the Russian incursion, because there are many that are crying in Congress for a major cyber attack against Russia because of this. But what Russia has done wasn't something that was warfare in the sense of they didn't shut out the lights on the East Coast. They gathered information, and this is the kind of spying that has gone on forever. If you were hold my feet to the fire, what I would say is that the response of the American cyber attacks will be to neutralize the Russian cyber capabilities. They won't go after intelligence. They won't go after their power plants, which we are in at this time, because I think that would be an unnecessary escalation. But I think they will do a dramatic attack on their abilities to make it. And as far as our capabilities, you know, we do keep hearing about Russia and China, and there's no question in particular those countries are good. We are every bit as good and better. We just keep it quieter. We don't get caught.
And you wonder how much is not being talked about, even in the wake of this last hack.
Oh, yeah.
That we don't want to show our cards. But what scares me in conclusion, and I hate being pessimistic or alarmist on a powerful medium such as this, but it's a question that, you know, just is apparent, is that with technological tentacles into all of the grid, the electrical power, the ability to communicate in terms of warplanes, missiles, rockets, bombs, we really are subject to the whims of even small rogue states that have the ability to perpetuate havoc upon us. And it's scary. You know, it's amazing we've gone this long without a second nuclear device. You know, I don't want to bring it on us even saying it going off. But, you know, it just seems that any weapon that's ever existed has been used. And it makes the future very frightening, to be honest with you. What are your thoughts about that?
Unfortunately, I have to agree with everything you said. And given as an example, when you say, you know, the rogue state, you look at Iran. And Iran is not a world power by any means. But Iran can be a world power and is a world power when it comes to cyber warfare. And if Iran can do it, so can other countries. And it really, I think, is going to create a great deal of havoc until the international community is able to get together and make enforceable rules and agree for international sanctions.
That's law professor Steve Weissman of Bentley University in Boston, who's also the founder of Scamicide.com. Coming up next, a look at 2020 from the perspective of professional sports. Part two of our conversation with sports talker extraordinaire Richard Neer of WFAN New York. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Attention homeowners, spending more time around your house means you're putting more stress on major appliances that keep your home running. Like many Americans, a major breakdown could be very costly during these uncertain times. AC unit goes, that's $4,500. Water heater breaks, $1,500. When you own a home, it's always something. If you have a home warranty, those repairs could cost you nothing. A Home Service Club warranty pays for the repair or replacement of your home appliances and systems when they break down, even from normal wear and tear. For about $1 a day, you can cover your home appliances and systems. It's not a question of if they'll break down, it's when. If you call now, you'll get your first month free and $75 off your first year. Make home appliance repairs one less thing to worry about. Call 800-259-1604 now for your free quote, free first month, and $75 off your first year. 800-259-1604 now. That's 800-259-1604. Again, 800-259-1604.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we go forward with part two of our discussion about the hottest topics of the past year. Let's return to the world of sports and the tremendous role it played in the national conversation about numerous topics, from the economy to race relations. We're joined again by legendary WFAN New York sports talk radio host and prolific author Richard Neer. On last week's program, we talked about gambling. Let's talk about the politics, because we were talking originally about the sports being a microcosm of life, and this has been a year of heavy politics. We talked about, of course, how COVID has impacted sports, but we've become so politicized. Has the contentiousness of our political environment made its way into the conversation? I've heard it said by a number of sports broadcasters, and to my own ear, because I am a sports fan, I'm not a gambling fan, but I'm a sports fan, that somehow the culture of sports talk tends to lean in a conservative direction. Is that true? And how much has it infiltrated the actual conversation on the air?
Well, just anecdotally, I would say you're correct that it does lean conservative, like most talk radio does. I think that in a lot of cases, I mean, this all started to come to a head with Colin Kaepernick 4 or 5 years ago, where he knelt during the national anthem in protest for police brutality and several other things. And, of course, the current president reacted to it, wanted to kick people off the team and, fire them for doing that, for protesting. But I think this past summer, between COVID and the situations that happened around the country with the police and people being killed, I think the leagues, especially the NBA, I think took the lead on this, said, I want my athletes to speak out. I want them to take causes, to the point where they were able to put slogans and endorsements on their jerseys or on their sneakers, supporting a certain cause. Now, these causes were vetted by the league. They couldn't just do anything, but they encouraged that. And Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the National Football League, admitted that he was wrong in blackballing Colin Kaepernick. He didn't say it quite in those words, but the fact that this was a talented guy who couldn't find a job, even though he was better than half the quarterbacks and backup quarterbacks in the league, he apologized for that. So I think there was much more of a social consciousness with the people who ran the sport. And maybe, and I guess they did research on this, I'm not exactly sure, but they felt it had reached critical mass where people would support the protests as opposed to saying, I'm not going to watch that sport anymore because these guys are unpatriotic. And that was something that was very interesting because, in the beginning, I would get phone calls after Kaepernick. Well, that's it. Not going to watch football anymore. They allow these guys to kneel, show disrespect for the flag, disrespect for the military and all of that. And in the last year, I haven't gotten many calls like that. People understand that the protests are not, against the country, against the police, but they are against injustice. And they seem to have taken that, most of the listeners seem to understand that. There are a few holdouts, but most are willing to put up with it. And some of them feel they have to put up with it as opposed to really support it. They don't like to see it, but they love the sport so much that they'll overlook the protests.
Well, I mean, they've gone so far as to actually have the words Black Lives Matter emblazoned in the, in the environment of the arenas, especially, mm-hmm. I believe, in basketball. Am I correct? Would you say basketball has been the one to most identify itself with the Black Lives Matter movement?
I would say so. I would say that. And, football on the back of the helmets, they have little messages and things that they support. Now, it's not as conspicuous, but, with TV and high definition and these cameras with these zoom lenses, you can see them, but they're not quite as obvious. But yes, I think the NBA was really took the lead on this, partially because of the timing. It happened in the summer when the league was just coming back. And the fact that 80% or so of the league are people of color.
What do you see happening going forward? Will sports get? Do you think arenas will be different? Do you think that crowds will come back? What do you think is going to happen over the next year or so?
Well, I do think the crowds will be back, but I think that even when the vaccine is pretty widespread and people feel fairly safe, I don't think that they're going to want to go into large groups. They're not going to want to go to arenas, packed arenas. Now, I think it's also generational. I think younger people will tend to come back and support it more than older people. But I also think that, you know, we've had a good period of time now where there weren't fans and people can watch it at home. And I think a lot of people are thinking, hey, you know what? With the technology now, I've got a big TV. I can see things that I could never see at the ballpark. I can see replays. I can now the camaraderie of going there with my friends. I can have them over to my house. Or what I found, and I'm doing this myself, is texting people who are friends watching the game, and we'll go, oh, I can't believe that play. What was he thinking? Those things. So you actually feel like you're part of the communal experience of being there without actually being there. And I think that will take the place of people going to games. Now, 2 or 3 years down the road, you know, our memories are short. And if we ever, we're never going to forget COVID-19, but if it becomes, oh yeah, you know, that was a bad year and things are back to normal, eventually I think you'll get sellout crowds again.
That's sports talk show host Richard Neer of WFAN in New York City. His website is richardneer.com. You're plugged into the New Year's weekend installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, we have time for one more. Let's wrap up our 2020 overview of the Wrap with a visit to our international woman in the nation's capital, Victoria Jones. Victoria Jones, we have come to the end of our two-hour special and our look back at the year 2020, and I can't think of a better way to finish it up than a conversation with you. So what's your take on this fabulous year?
Move on!
You have something interesting for us from...
The Oxford English Dictionary, no less, has its words of 2020, and the top 20 of 2020 are alphabetically, and then we can play, Black Lives Matter, Blur's Day, Circuit Breaker, Contact Tracing, Doom Scrolling, Essential Workers, Flatten the Curve, Frontline Workers, Hydroxychloroquine, Mail-in Ballot, Pod, PPE, Remote Learning, Social Distancing, Super Spreader, Unprecedented, Virtual Happy Hour, Voter Fraud, Wildfires, Zoom.
And Zoom would be last because that's Zed. That's interesting. These are not words. These are phrases in some cases.
Yes.
So I know quite often on talk radio, a company based in Springfield, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, actually does every year not just the popular words, but the new words that are installed in the dictionary. And it's usually maybe two or three. This is not necessarily dictionary terms. This is their observation of words and phrases that became popular in the year 2020. One that jumped out at me was doom scrolling. Did I hear that correctly? Doom, or was it doomsday?
Yes.
Scrolling? So what did you say about doom scrolling?
Doom scrolling. Well, it's like doomsday scrolling. It is doom scrolling, and it's a particular type of scrolling through your phone or through your tablet where you just can't stop, and you're reading bad news. It could be bad news about what's going on in the news, or it could be bad news about COVID or about something. And whatever it is, you're either reading more and more posts, or it might be live updates, and you keep clicking with your fingers to get more live updates, and it's all bad, and you can't stop, and you're scrolling, and it's doom, and it's doom, and it's doom, but it's completely addictive, and you're a complete addict, and you won't stop, and suddenly 5 hours have gone.
Have you had the experience lately And this, I think, is something that is reflective of the year where people are saying to you, I am stopping watching and reading the news because it's making me sick. Has anybody told you that?
Yes. And in fact, my two most politically active friends who are constantly saying to me, I hate it, I can't stand it, it's, oh, and I walk into their house and it's blaring out at me. And I said, well, why is it on? I said, I don't have the news on in my house. I listen to the radio or I read. I won't have television news on most of the time unless there's a particular event. Oh, and I went over to their place for Hanukkah. And I went in and they had the news on. And she says to me, we don't have the sound on anymore. And she made that decision. Finally, my friend, I looked at her husband and he rolled his eyes because it's been driving him mad for about 2 years. Finally, it had so got to her that even my friend has turned the sound off.
You know, it's strange, Victoria. It's true. People are saying to you, they're saying to me, and I've asked a number of other people, that they're getting sick, that they can't take it anymore, that they're walking around with gut wrench, and obviously, the emotional issues, the psychological issues that people are facing, have created a pandemic of despair in the United States. So. It's not just, a physical thing. It's an emotional thing. But what I've noticed is a counter problem, and the opposite problem, and it concerns me very much, is that we're dealing with outrageous statistics at the time that we're having this conversation. And we're about a week and a couple of days ahead of the new year, so the number is going to grow after when people finally hear this particular discussion as we put together this two-part edition of the Michael Harrison Wrap. That there have been 18.3 million cases of the coronavirus, 18.3 million in the United States, and 323,000 people, and by the time, again, this New Year's weekend, when it's running, it's going to be more. That is an extraordinarily high number of deaths. I mean, it's so far beyond how many people died over an 8-year period in Vietnam, a 4-year period in world wars. It's insane, and we roll with it, and I think that we're numb to it. I think that there's a numbness to the amount of deaths that are taking place on a daily basis. When you think about how we reacted to 9/11 and a few thousand deaths, how do you wrap your brain around a human life and one death, let alone that many? And my own personal theory is that we sublimated in our emotional system so that we could function, so that we don't get sick, so that we don't become gut-wrenched. And maybe they are tied together. Some people just can't do that anymore. But I do find maybe it's people in the media. They just become statistics. And it's just numbers. And ceases to have the type of level of tragedy that it really does represent. And I hope we don't come out of this with a diminishment of our sensitivity and our empathy. But then again, maybe it's only because we're using this as a denial to come to grips with it, and that all of a sudden, 6 months from now, a year from now, we're going to go, oh my gosh, do you believe what's happened? Thank you, Victoria Jones, Executive Director of the DC Radio Company, for joining us, and I certainly wish you the happiest new year. And that brings us to the conclusion of part two of this special year-in-review installment of our show for New Year's weekend, 2020 in Review. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. Happy New Year. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in association with Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.